This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Interesting topic today, Tracy, epilepsy. Yeah. You know, we all know someone who has epilepsy, but what we may not understand is the profound effect that this condition, these multiple seizures can have on a patient's life. And the other thing we don't understand is why it happens. You know, actually, sometimes we do know, but oftentimes we don't.
Yeah, today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll meet two neurologists, and actually more than that, we'll have three of them joining us.
From all around the country.
Yeah, that's right. In studio, we have Dr. Elaine Wuerl. She is a pediatric epileptologist.
I didn't know if you were going to pronounce that right
or not. I got it.
Epileptologist.
Yes. Yep. She's from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester here. And by telephone, Dr. Jerry Shee, he's a neurologist at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, and an Arizona doctor chiming in as well. We're going to talk about what it means to have epilepsy. What we know about what causes it, and we'll find out about the different types of seizures. We'll also talk about treatment, like drugs, some of the newest ones that are available.
I think there are twice as many drugs now as there were a decade ago. So they have a lot of alternatives for treatment these days.
Speaking of alternatives, we'll talk about some alternative treatments, for instance, special diets, and the promising new procedure that's called thermoablation.
Plus, The other thing you mentioned earlier, right. Is it safe for someone with epilepsy to drive? We'll have a Mayo Clinic neurologist from Scottsdale weigh in on that subject. But first, you know, there are a lot of people with arthritis out there, but even when I found out how many actually have arthritis, it even surprised me. The latest figures from the CDC say that almost 23% of us, that's 52 million adults in this country, almost a fourth of the adult population in the United States have arthritis. It's an epidemic. I almost said epileptology. It's an epidemic that's spreading steadily and painfully joint by joint.
Yes.
Joining us by telephone, Mayo rheumatologist, Dr. Shreyasi Amin. Dr. Amin, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So how do you account for these large numbers and tell us where they came from?
Sure. Well, you know, I think it's important to recognize that in this study, they combined all forms of arthritis, not just the one that we think most commonly of, such as osteoarthritis, that we mostly get as we get older, but among other risk factors. But by combining these less known forms of arthritis, such as rheumatoid arthritis or arthritis from a disease called lupus and even gout, we really understand the impact that it can affect the population in general. Also, we can see that as people are getting older, as our population is older population is getting larger in number, that's affecting a greater proportion of the population. And one of the other things that we have to keep in mind is, you know, the obesity epidemic. Osteoarthritis in particular is associated with being obese, and as our population in general is getting more overweight, that might be contributing another reason for osteoarthritis, in particular of the knee, becoming more frequent.
So we hear, you know, we're getting older as a nation, and so I guess a lot of people just think, well, arthritis goes hand in hand with aging, but there are other complications that make a big difference. What are some of those complications?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to remember is that it may not be an inevitable consequence of getting older, and if we can do things to prevent the risk factors that may be contributing to it, such as being overweight, that's important. And the issue is in part that people become less physically active when their joints hurt. And if they become less physically active, they're more likely to gain weight. And then, unfortunately, from there, it may also lead to other complications that we know are associated with obesity, such as heart disease, such as diabetes, high blood pressure, among other things.
Sure, because if you don't want to exercise because it hurts when you exercise, then you get less healthy overall.
Correct.
So what are the important things that people can do to try to prevent it? Obviously, the first one that you mentioned is maintain a healthy weight. Get the weight off. And that takes a significant amount of stress off of the joints, doesn't it?
It does. You know, we talk about if you decrease your weight by even a pound, that's almost 4 pounds less loading that you might, your knee might experience. But I think people need to realize there's no quick fixes. You know, a slow, steady attempt to change your lifestyle and watch your diet be a healthy diet, but also exercise. That's so important for weight loss, not just diet or pills to help people lose weight. Exercise has so much more benefit on the joints themselves, and it sounds counterintuitive for people when they have joint pain, but exercise such as low-impact activities will be very important for helping the mobility, maintaining the strength around their joints so they don't injure them further during their activities, too.
So you're saying that if you are able to strengthen the muscles around a joint, that can help de-stress the joint, take the stress off the joint?
We believe so. Certainly a number of studies show that if you've got stronger muscles around your joints, like for your knee, for example, you have less pain as well as less likely progression of the arthritis.
If 23% of us have arthritis or are going to get arthritis, though, we need some help with what to do once we have it. So give us some coping tips.
Well, I think one of the things that's really important, I guess, as we talked about, is staying active. But if you've got arthritis, trying to do things that don't strain your joints further. So if you've got arthritis in the knees, a raised toilet seat, for example, will help you at least get up without hurting your joints, but also without needing to push yourself off and add further strain to your shoulders, for example. There's a lot of devices that we have for people with arthritis of their hands so they can enjoy their day-to-day activities, even reading books. There's devices to help hold them, things to help them build up the grips of pencils or pens when they're writing. Even if they like golfing, bigger grips are available so that they can enjoy those activities too.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Amin. Good to have you.
Thank you.
So isn't it interesting? You know, obesity is such a huge problem in this country, and the numbers aren't getting any better. 2/3 of Americans are obese, and we think of it in general as leading to an increased incidence of diabetes, but also heart disease, and now arthritis. So a number of very difficult, untoward complications, all related to obesity.
We got to
continue to work on that.
Well, and another reason why we have to keep working out is the bigger point. No excuse for exercise.
Right, but aren't you sort of impressed with the people around here who work here who have been on a diet recently, including the mayor of our city?
Yeah,
much weight they've lost.
And you know, I know that I have a relative who's also lost quite a significant amount of weight. And just to hear them talk about after a whole lifetime of being overweight, that you lose 20 pounds, 30 pounds, what a huge difference it makes just every day. And I know that our mayor has said the same thing, that it just all of a sudden you're 20 pounds lighter, you're 30 pounds lighter, and your whole life has changed.
And let's just see if they can keep it off.
Yeah.
That's the difficult part,
isn't
it?
That's right. It's time for a short break. It's Epilepsy Awareness Month. Did you know? Bought a card?
November.
Yeah.
Yep. My button.
Coming up, we're going to talk with epilepsy experts, Dr. Jerry Shi and Dr. Elaine Wuerl, plus our myth or matter of fact. People are born with epilepsy.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our epilepsy experts at 507-282-1234, or you can contact us by going to our Mayo Clinic website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or tweet us, #MayoClinicRadio. We're back right after this. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Dr. Tom Shives, along with Tracy McRae. Our guests today are all epilepsy experts, and we have three of them from around the country. In studio, Dr. Elaine Wuerl. Dr. Wuerl, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And you are, I think, a specialist in children's epilepsy, correct?
That's right. I see children with epilepsy usually until about up to age 18.
All right.
And then you hand them off to Dr. Shi.
I hand them off to people like Dr. Shi. That's correct.
And Dr. Shi is with us from the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville by telephone. Dr. Shi, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So we mentioned earlier that we all pretty much know somebody who has epilepsy. We may have even seen someone have an epileptic seizure. But what we probably don't all understand is the real significant impact this disease can have on a patient's life. That's true, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. You know, epilepsy is one of those diseases that can really affect the patient and can affect the quality of life. But I think it's important for people to know that epilepsy doesn't have to control your life. There are many people in the United States that have epilepsy. In fact, I suspect we all know of one, either in our families or our communities. In Minnesota, for example, Mr. Jerry Kill, who's coach of the University of Minnesota football team, has epilepsy. I think that's been in the news lately. Chief Justice Roberts has epilepsy, and he's done quite well. So I think it's very important to realize that that people can do well with epilepsy and can lead very meaningful lives.
Dr. Shi, I think one of the things you mentioned, Coach Kill here at the University of Minnesota, one of the things that you hear about in the media anyway is that he is trying to learn to control his epilepsy. Is that the key? I mean, first off, can epilepsy be controlled? Is that a good word to use for this circumstance?
Yeah, epilepsy can, to a certain degree, be influenced by a number of factors, and I think the doctors working with Coach Kill are really trying to make it so that his seizures can be controlled to the best that they can be with medications, with other behavioral aspects. So absolutely, I think to a large degree, many patients with seizure disorders can find that their seizures can be controlled to a large degree.
And I think, you know, he has had some seizures when he's on the sideline during a game, which leads the, again, the talk show people to say, well, it must be stress-induced. Is epilepsy, are seizures stress-induced?
You know, epilepsy to a certain degree is caused by abnormal electrical activity in the brain. I tell my patients that, you know, our brain cells communicate by way of electrical signals to each other. And seizures occur when there is abnormal electrical activity, when the brain cells start generating massive amounts of electrical energy that causes other brain cells to not function as well. There are a number of things that can cause the brain cells to be more electrically irritable or to be more electrically stable. And certainly stress is one of those things that can make cells more electrically irritable and more apt to fire off. So absolutely, the ability to sort of control stress is makes those cells less apt to fire in an abnormal manner.
How big a problem are we talking about? What percent of the population has epilepsy?
Yeah, the recent studies indicate that 1 in 26 Americans have epilepsy or a seizure disorder. So it's a quite common problem. One in 26, and every year, somewhere between 150,000 to 200,000 Americans get diagnosed with epilepsy. So, and if you live to the age of 80, the chances of having one seizure in your lifetime is about 10%. So, but recognize that having one seizure does not equal epilepsy. By definition, epilepsy means having the propensity to have recurrent, unprovoked seizures. So you have to have at least two unprovoked seizures in your lifetime to be given that diagnosis.
And Dr. Wuerl, if you're a, well, I'm going to give it another try here, a pediatric epileptologist.
Good.
are most people diagnosed when they are children? Or if he just said you can live to 80 and have a seizure, when are people diagnosed with epilepsy?
Yeah, so epilepsy can really come on at any time in life, but it is certainly more common in young children. And then there's another peak of occurrence sort of later on in older adults. So we tend to see kind of two peaks, one in young children and then one in older adults.
One of the myths that I came across was, myth or matter of fact, you can outgrow epilepsy.
Well, unfortunately, that's actually, there's a yes and a no for that. So
that's a sign of a good question.
You can waffle on that one a little bit.
So how is that?
So many children who have epilepsy actually have self-limited, age-limited disorders. And so the young brain, actually, the way that it's structured, and it's structured with chemicals to help the young brain learn, and that's why kids learn very quickly. But unfortunately, those same chemicals can increase the propensity to seizures. And so as the child grows and their brain sort of becomes more of an adult brain, we don't learn quite as quickly as young children, but I guess the benefit of that is that the brain tends to be less prone to seizures. So there's many seizure disorders in children that ultimately will be outgrown.
But not necessarily that they're epilepsy.
They are epilepsy,
okay, gotcha.
And epilepsy will be outgrown many times in children. Oftentimes that depends on the cause, and we can often be very can get good information when we're actually seeing the child initially, and we can, you know, sometimes be able to predict that for the families, there's a high likelihood or versus a low likelihood of outgrowing the seizures.
Well, let's also then go to, I just want to say, Dr. Shi, our myth or matter of fact that we had on our Facebook page was that people are born with epilepsy. Dr. Shi, is that a fair statement?
Well, as Dr. Worrell indicated, there are certain types of seizures in which they tend to actually, some run in families. So as far as whether you're born with it is a very difficult, again, question to answer. But we do know that there are some types of seizures that run in families. So if you are born to a family that has a number of family members with seizures and you have that kind of seizure propensity, then it's more likely to develop epilepsy.
How often, Dr. Worrell, do you know the cause of the underlying cause of seizures, whether it be familial or infection or tumor, et cetera? And how often is it what we call idiopathic? You just don't know why they have the seizure.
Yeah, so we still are struggle with probably a third of cases of epilepsy where we don't really understand what causes it. And the patient doesn't fall into a particular what we would call epilepsy syndrome, where we know very clearly what the long-term outcome of that epilepsy is going to be. So about a third of the time, we're still struggling. I think the important thing is we've made huge advances in the last 10, 15 years, just in our understanding of the genetics that are behind epilepsy, and also our ability to actually look at the brain, take a picture of the brain, and be able to determine different structural causes in the brain that can result in epilepsy.
When you talk about the causes of epilepsy, and let's rule out the familial ones, and the idiopathic ones. When you do know what causes it, what's the most common cause?
So oftentimes the most common cause is a structural change in the brain. So, and that can be a change that the patient is actually born with. That can happen as their brain is developing while they're still in the womb. Oftentimes we don't know what causes that, but we can see on tests like MRI scans a structural change in the brain. Sometimes the structural change can be something that happens after you're born. So, for example, somebody who gets a bad head injury, mm-hmm. You can have scarring in the brain that can then lead to seizures.
You know, we hear all about the former NFL players who have had multiple head injuries, and they seem to end up with some form of dementia. Do they ever have seizures?
They would have a higher risk of seizures. Any head injury, particularly the more severe head injuries, would increase the risk of seizures. And interestingly, we think that in many cases, there's probably a genetic contribution there too, that, you know, people can have same degrees of head injury. Somebody with a greater sort of genetic predisposition to then have seizures may develop seizures after a head injury of a similar degree, and somebody else without that genetic predisposition may not.
We know that patients with epilepsy face a lot of challenges, and one of those is driving. And the question comes up, should patients with epilepsy be allowed to drive? And we have an expert on the phone who's actually studied this issue.
That's
and
right.
He is from the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona, Dr. Joseph Drazkowski. Dr. Drazkowski, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Well, thanks for having me this morning.
You know, we were talking about Coach Kill here at the University of Minnesota, and so many talking heads and talk radio and in the media talk about his case, and of course we don't know anything about it. So that's kind of what this is all about too, what the media has influenced people's thoughts about epilepsy. Tell us about your study.
Well, some time ago now, a couple of years ago, we were interested in how people are portrayed in the media with regard to driving. As you know, every state in the country, or you may know, every state in the country has a restriction against the person with active epilepsy driving. And there's a big misnomer about what epilepsy is at this point in time. And you can see from the reporting on locally there, but we noticed in the media back then, when a person with epilepsy had a driving issue, they were portrayed as something a menace against society when they're really not. It's really uncommon for a person with epilepsy to have a seizure while driving.
Yeah, I think that overall you would say, oh, that person is being reckless and doesn't care about their safety or ours.
No, it's actually the majority of patients with epilepsy or people with epilepsy are very cognizant of the law. They're very cognizant of the restrictions that they have on their licenses. It's actually their number one issue. When you talk about social issues and epilepsy, that's their most concern. They're concerned, all the adults are concerned with their ability to keep driving for mobility and for, you know, basically self-esteem.
So is there a higher incidence of accidents in patients with epilepsy who drive compared to the general population, excluding teenagers?
Exclusive of teenagers. That's a very good point. Teenagers pose some of the highest risk, and as you may know, some of the older population above 85, they're very high. They're very high risk drivers as well. But when you compare patients with epilepsy or people with epilepsy to other conditions such as stroke, even psychiatry conditions, diabetes, generally they're safe. They're as safe or safer than those conditions.
Yeah, it's an excellent point that you make in this study that epilepsy epileptics have to have this restriction, but those other ones do not.
Yeah, there are a few states with some very minor restrictions. People are starting to look at the Alzheimer's conditions because, degenerative conditions reduce reaction time and they get lost. They just don't have the physical skills. It's a challenge. It's a challenge when comparing to other people. But people, when it comes to people with epilepsy, when they get in trouble, when they have an accident, they're very well, very much scrutinized because it's often spelled out specifically in the law what they must do, whereas the other people do not have that same prescription.
Now, the laws vary from state to state, don't they, with regard to the criteria that they use to whether or not you can get a driver's license and can drive?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And the restriction is often based on what we call the seizure-free interval, or the time from the last seizure. For example, in Arizona, we're one of the most liberal states. I know Arizona, but we're one of the most liberal states when it comes to this. And we have a three-month restriction. And I understand that Minnesota just changed that, too, based on some of the work we've done a few years ago.
That's right.
All right. Dr. Joseph Drozdowski, thanks so much for being with us. The weather good down there in Arizona?
I'm actually at a Mayo Clinic talk in Tucson, and it's sunshine and about 80 degrees. It's unbelievable. Y'all come out and visit us.
Sorry, Why did you ask him that?
Yep. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest, epilepsy experts, Dr. Shi and Wuerl, coming up this week's Health and Medical. And by the way, we'll tell you coming up what to do if you experience someone having a seizure. News with Vivian Williams, then your phone calls, 507-282-1234, and your tweets, hashtag Mayo Radio.
It's hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. It may be hard to believe, but researchers are still learning new things about the anatomy of the human body. Two knee surgeons in Belgium found a previously undescribed ligament in the human knee. It seems to be important for people with anterior cruciate ligament or ACL tears. Now, even after successful ACL surgery, some people continue to have their knees give out during activity. These researchers are trying to figure out why. They started by checking out reports of the existence of an additional ligament located on the knee. Well, that turned out to be correct. Their research shows the presence of what's called the anterolateral ligament, or ALL. More research shows knees that give out in patients with ACL tears are caused by an injury in the ALL ligament. They're looking at surgical ways to fix this, and it's published in the journal Anatomy. And from Mayo Clinic, palliative care, a specialized multidisciplinary team approach for caring for seriously ill people and their families, is often reduced to end-of-life care. This misconception has led to palliative care involvement being introduced late in an illness, when its interventions are no longer beneficial or no longer desired by the patient. An article in the journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings describes 10 things palliative care clinicians wished everyone knew about palliative care. Things such as palliative care is appropriate at any stage of serious illness, and palliative care enhances health care value. Here's Dr. Elise Carey.
I think what people worry about when they get us involved is that somehow means they'll die sooner, and that isn't what we see. We see people's symptoms get better controlled. We now have some evidence that it's not true, but when people's symptoms are better controlled, they can function better, they can do more, their body isn't as stressed. We have every reason to believe that that's a good thing for helping them live not only better, but maybe even a little bit longer.
And now, looking for what's behind the pain of fibromyalgia. New research shows a disruption of brain signals for reward and punishment contributes to increased pain sensitivity. It's called hyperalgesia. Researchers say this might contribute to widespread pain and lack of response to opioid therapy. Now, fibromyalgia is a chronic musculoskeletal syndrome characterized by widespread joint and muscle pain, plus other symptoms such as fatigue and sleep problems. Researchers from Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School say their findings suggest people with fibromyalgia may have altered brain responses to the expectation of and relief from pain. They say more studies needed to figure it all out. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know, on air, online, and you can pick us up. You can listen to us anywhere on iHeartRadio. It's time for you to join our conversation with epilepsy experts, Dr. Jerry Shi of the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville and Dr. Elaine Wuerl, Mayo Clinic Rochester. She is in studio. Our telephone number, 507-282-1234, or you can contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Leave your comment or your question there, or tweet us at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
Right. We have some hashtag questions. I want to just get one of them out of the way right now. And it's about kids, so we'll send this one over to Dr. Wuerl. How likely are children to outgrow juvenile myoclonic epilepsy? First of all, what is that?
So juvenile myoclonic epilepsy is one of the most common types of epilepsy that we see, and it usually presents in teenage years or early adult years, and it presents with what we would call a generalized tonic-clonic seizure, as well as some myoclonic seizures, which look like just some quick jerks. People who have that, that's one of the forms of epilepsy that we think has a genetic cause to it, and people who have that are otherwise normal, healthy individuals. That one has a lower chance of being outgrown. It's usually something that persists through life, although there's now been some interesting studies that have come out sort of following people who have this condition longer term, and after about 20 or 30 years, it looks that maybe even 15 to 20% of people may ultimately be able to come off medication, but overall, we generally counsel people that it's a pretty low likelihood you would outgrow that kind of epilepsy.
Ah, good. Say, Dr. Shi, we know that there are different kinds of seizures. Briefly, how would you characterize seizures and the different kinds?
Yeah. I tell my patients that there are two main types of seizures, if you will, what we call focal seizures and then what we call generalized seizures. Focal seizures are seizures that begin either in one part or one side of the brain, whereas generalized seizures, usually the electrical abnormality or discharge occurs on both sides, as far as we know, simultaneously. So that really separates it into sort of two main types. And the reason that's important is because the treatments for these two different types of seizures are different.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, for focal seizures, you oftentimes begin, the patients will know that they have a certain warning or what we call an aura. It could be a certain type of smell, a certain type of unusual taste. It can be an unusual vision or tingling. And the reason for that is because that part of the brain is being affected by that abnormal electrical activity. So, for example, if the part of the brain that controls your right hand is where the electrical activity, abnormal electrical activity is starting, you can actually feel some unusual sensation in that hand or even some unusual movements. So focal seizures usually begin with a little bit of a warning, whereas generalized seizures oftentimes don't.
Our phone number is 507-282-1234. And Brad has a question that's going to take us to the next thing that we were going to ask about. So Brad, go ahead and ask your question.
Good morning. Could you talk about the ketogenic diet, please?
Yeah, so the ketogenic diet is a special diet that we use more often in children, although we now, there's been more work and it has been used very successfully in adolescents and adults as well. There's a number of different kinds of ketogenic diets, and the most traditional one, which actually was initially described at Mayo Clinic back in the 1920s, involves a very carefully calculated diet, which is very high in fat, very low in carbohydrate, And so that diet is generally calculated and administered by a dietitian who has special training in that area. And so if your child is on the ketogenic diet, that's all they can eat. They can't sort of go to a restaurant and pick something that they would like off the menu. Everything is very, very carefully calculated. We tend to use that more in children who have difficult seizures that are not responding to medication. And overall, our success with that, about 50% of children have a greater than 50% reduction in their seizures, and somewhere between 10 and 15% are seizure-free. And you may think that that's a low number, but these are kids who have already, you know, not responded well to several seizure medicines. And so for many, many patients, we can have a very significant benefit with that diet. Now, there are other types of ketogenic diets. One is called the modified Atkins diet. The second is a low glycemic index diet, which is very similar to the South Beach. And those are a lot easier for adolescents and adults because they are not as carefully calculated, and they can often have very similar beneficial effects.
Why does or should this diet work?
So there's a lot of different theories for that. The bottom line is nobody knows the correct answer, but the bottom line is we think that it probably stabilizes the nerve cells.
Interesting. And why did someone invent this diet? They just
thought
it might
work. Yeah.
So the history on this is really interesting. So it actually dates back to when fasting was prescribed for epilepsy. And early on, back in the early last century, people were prescribing fasting therapies for epilepsy, which helped the seizures, but is not a great long-term effect for a growing child. You can't fast them indefinitely. So the ketogenic diet was actually designed to mimic the fasting state.
Wow. Hey, Brad, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Our son is on it, and it worked wonders.
Very good. Thanks for calling in.
How old is your son?
12.
Oh, good.
That's great.
Well, I'm glad it's working.
Thanks, Brad.
Thank you. Bye.
I think one of the things that is the most frightening part about this is the actual seizure itself. So both for the patient and the family, and then for just the people all around the person having the seizure. Dr. Shi, let's just talk about what should you do when going through a seizure from the patient's perspective and the folks that are there to support them.
Right. The important thing to know about seizures is it's self-limited. The vast majority of seizures last somewhere between 30 seconds to a couple of minutes. So while the family understandably feel that seizure is lasting forever, the vast majority of seizures will stop by themselves. During the actual time that the seizure is occurring, it's important to have the patient be in a safe place. So if they're in a place where there are sharp objects, if they're standing up or being propped up, they need to be taken to a lying position where they're not next to any sharp objects. If possible, have a cushion under them so that they don't bang their heads on sharp objects or the floor. There's always this myth about putting something in the mouth so that people don't swallow their tongue. Well, that's a myth. People don't swallow their tongue during a seizure, and it's actually important not to put something in the mouth because, especially with what we call a grand mal seizure, they can actually bite down and bite off whatever's in the mouth. I've had family members say, well, I want to stick my finger in there so that they don't swallow their tongue. Family members have had their fingers bitten, so
wow.
It's important to not stick anything in the mouth. So turn the patient on their side, have a cushion if at all possible, support them so that they don't injure themselves by banging their head or their extremities against hard objects.
And what about, I have a child in elementary school, and locally they just had a presentation, actually it was last year, they had a presentation on epilepsy, and I think the epilepsy local group here, there's a lady who is very involved in that, and I know around the country that happens, that the Epilepsy Foundation of America is helping. What do kids need to know about epilepsy? Dr. Wuerl?
So I think that, first of all, having the Epilepsy Foundation come in, and they have a great program where they will teach kids to be seizure smart and will teach adults to be seizure smart. So that's a super good place to start.
Well, and the fear of it is one of the biggest problems.
Yeah. But I think it's the fear of the unknown.
Sure.
It looks very frightening. You don't know what to do. You're worried about what's going to happen to that person. And I think once you're given the tools, you know what to do, then you're not scared of it anymore. So I think for children, they can certainly be taught to roll the patient onto their side, and then I think they need to be told to, or they need to know to go get an adult, a teacher or a supervisor of some sort.
We have the information about the Epilepsy Foundation of America and the National Academy of Neurology on our webpage, so you can go there for those links to learn more, and that's radio.mayoclinic.org.
All right, we are Mayo Clinic Radio, and we are with epilepsy experts from both the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville and in Rochester, and I want to talk to Helen.
All right, Helen is on the line with a question. Good morning, Helen.
Actually, I have two questions, if you have time. How does exercise trigger a seizure, and what's the best kind of exercise for people with seizures, and how does stress trigger seizures?
All right, Dr. Xi, let's talk about exercise.
Great question. Absolutely great question. We actually tell patients to engage in what we call mild to moderate exercise. It's very important for patients with seizures and actually all people to have good exercise, because that does a couple of things. One, it keeps the body healthy. And number two, to get to the second part of the question, it actually lowers the stress levels in the body. But the question being, can exercise or does exercise trigger seizures? The answer is in that the vast majority of people, exercise does not trigger seizures. I will say, however, in my practice, I have had a couple of patients say to me, every time I go to the gym and I do this thing or I work out past a certain time, I tend to get more seizures, or it tends to trigger my seizures. So in a small, very small percentage of people, I would expect that maybe a certain thing that they do may help lower what we call the seizure threshold and trigger their seizures. But for the vast majority of people, exercise does not cause or trigger seizures.
Go ahead,
as far as the stress aspect, second part of the question, in terms of stress, we talked about the fact that seizures are caused when the brain cells become more electrically unstable and can fire off massive amounts of electrical energy. That's what a seizure is. There are certain things that make those cells more stable, electrically stable, and then more electrically unstable. Exercise tends to make them more stable. Stress tends to make them more unstable. So stress, and the underlying reason for this is not well worked out, but it's thought that stress causes changes in the body, changes in stress hormones, and maybe that has an effect on those brain cells, causing them to be more electrically unstable and more prone to fire off into a seizure.
Dr. Worrell?
Yeah, so I would agree. I think it's really important to encourage exercise. One of the questions that families often have are in children who have a kind of seizure called an absence seizure, where they will simply stare unresponsively. And those seizures can actually be triggered by hyperventilation. And that's something we will do in the office to see if their patient is controlled. We'll have them do some deep breathing. And because of that, many people think, geez, if deep breathing brings it on in the office, how about when you're exercising?
Right.
And in fact, exercise is protective. So it's the deep breathing that really changes the carbon dioxide levels in the body. And with exercise, you are doing compensatory deep breathing. So exercise does not pose a risk to those children.
You know, we know that for years you've used drugs, prescription medications, to control seizures, and you've really been pretty successful at that. But I believe it's true that up to a third of patients who have seizures, you're unable to control just with medications. And we've talked about ketogenic diet, which can be helpful in certain instances. But there are some surgical procedures that can be done, and one of the newest is a procedure called thermal ablation. Can you tell us about that, Dr. Xi?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the treatments for patients who don't respond to medication has been traditional brain surgery, and I want to sort of take us back a little bit. So traditional brain surgery to treat epileptic seizures has been around for about 40, 50 years, and I don't need to go into detail about what traditional brain surgery is. I'm sure all of us and our viewers can imagine what it would take in terms of having your skull opened up and then a part of the brain taken out. That's traditional brain surgery. There is an exciting new procedure that's been around probably for about 3 or so years, and it's called laser thermal ablation. And what it basically is it's a minimally invasive surgical procedure that allows us to, through a little hole that's drilled in the skull, introduce a catheter to the area of the brain that's causing seizures, and then using laser heat, knock out that area and ablate the seizure focus thereby with the goal of making the patient seizure-free.
Now, that's incredible. But how do you figure out where that spot is?
Right, and that goes to the diagnosis part of the seizures. And as you heard me say before, a certain percentage of patients have what we call focal seizures. That's where their seizures are beginning in one part of the brain or one side of the brain. And with a number of testing techniques, with EEG, video EEG, brain scanning with MRI, and then even more sophisticated scanning techniques like PET scan, magnetoencephalography, we're able to pinpoint where the seizures are coming from. And once we know where the seizures are coming from, those patients are candidates for this thermal ablation procedure.
Wow, incredible.
Yeah.
How what percentage of your patients can that help?
In our patient population, probably we're looking at about anywhere from about 30 to 50% of the patients who are looking to get traditional brain surgery may be candidates for thermal ablation. I want to emphasize we're still at the preliminary stage. This is still undergoing study, but there's a lot of excitement about this particular procedure. And I just want to sort of share an anecdote with our listeners, and that is this. One of our patients at Mayo Clinic Jacksonville is a young lady who has had seizures. She is now in her early 20s. She's had seizures, focal seizures, since she was an early teenager. And she had one of those seizure types in which there was a clear focus that was defined, but she just didn't want to have traditional brain surgery. She just didn't like the idea of having her hair shaved and her head shaved. And so she just resisted that, and she continued to have seizures, went through school with difficulty, was not being able to hire it on for a job. When this procedure came about, she signed on immediately and says, I want to try it. I want to go ahead and do this. And it is now 9 months since her procedure. She is seizure-free. She is able to legally drive in the state of Florida. And she's working at Starbucks, which is what she wanted to do.
Wow, what a fantastic story. And so caffeine doesn't set off her seizures. So, you know, that is, it's unbelievable that you're able to do that. And these patients, after they've had this procedure, are able to get off their medications in most instances?
Yeah. You know, with traditional epilepsy surgery and with this thermal ablation technique, we actually have a protocol in which we advise patients to stay on their seizure medications for at least a couple of years. And the reason for that is you want the brain to heal after a surgical procedure, and you want to make sure that the patient isn't going to have a recurrent seizure. So we actually want patients to stay on medications for a couple of years. After that, we have a conversation with them. We do certain types of other types of testing, and then we have a conversation in regards to whether or not they would like to get off of medication.
Jerry Shee from Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate the great information.
You're most welcome. It's been my pleasure.
And Dr. Elaine Wuerl, Mayo Clinic Rochester, children's, you say the word?
Epileptologist.
Thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate all
the
information.
You.
Good job. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk about palliative care with two physicians from Mayo, Dr. Timothy Moynihan, Dr. Jacob Strand. Palliative care, it's for anyone who's been diagnosed with a serious illness. And, you know, I'm glad it's out there because someday I might need it and you might need it. And I might need it before you need it.
Well, I was going to say I hope so, but I don't want that. I don't want to talk about that. But that is the problem, is that people don't want to talk about what happens toward the end of their life. And palliative care is not to be confused with hospice, which
exactly.
The two can go hand in hand. But it's interesting, patients who use palliative care end up living longer than other people diagnosed with the same condition.
Right, and because palliative care can be initiated anytime during the illness, not just when you're terminal. When next week, we'll tell you who can benefit from palliative care, who pays for it, how do you get a referral for palliative care, and can it be done as an outpatient? We want you to know that palliative care will help people with a serious illness to make it as easy as possible to get through that serious time in your life. All about palliative care next week on Mayo Clinic Clinic Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of the program, those web links that we talked about, and listen to previous episodes. You can also go to mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers help you empower and manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCrae.
Thanks for listening.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.